My name's Diana Clark, and I'm an alcoholic. I always think of all these things I'm going to remember to do right at the beginning of my talk, kind of waiting for it to kick in. But what I want, first of all, I want to thank the Al-Anon family group. It's a lot of jokes that go back and forth between Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, but I can't tell the people in this room and those you know in Al-Anon, thank you enough for what you've done in supporting those of us who are your drunks, what you've done in helping me live my life. You've taught me things I would have never learned in AA. Thank you. I always kind of secretly wanted to be a teacher, so this is kind of... You won't learn anything, but I'll have a good time. This is so strange. I feel like I'm on some stage or something. I guess I am on a stage. There won't be any encore, so forget that. You know, we all have preconceptions and probably misconceptions about different places in the country, and you know, everybody thinks Tulsa's teepees and cowboys and Indians, and I always think of Nebraska as kind of hard-working, stoic farming type people. I was kind of surprised you had AA up here because I didn't think you'd have time to drink. That's already, I mean, you just seem, Nebraskans are so sensible. And I got out there, I got off in Lincoln, you know, I went to the bathroom in the airport. And my first hint that things weren't as sensible as I thought were those little condoms you have on the toilet seats in your bathrooms. Those little automatic, crunched-up vegetable bags or something. And I do want to tell you that I couldn't figure out how to make it go around and change for me, so if there's something you get around here, I've got it now. And before I could get out of the stall, it recognizes foreigners. Before I could get out of the stall, the toilet flushed twice on its own. So then I thought, well, that's okay. You know, probably someone from out of state designed the bathrooms in the airport. And I'm sitting up here at this thing, and Ann's telling Vicki that when Vicki just called her, she had grease all over because she's trying to fix her garage door. And I'm looking at this pretty little demure woman named Ann, and she said, I had to get down on the ground and roll under the door to get back in. And I'm like, so I thought I didn't know anyone, but I see you all are just like me. It's an honor. It's a big honor that anybody wants me anywhere. But what an honor it is that you want me at a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous so I can tell you what's happened in my life. I can't think of a bigger honor. And I thank the committee, and I thank Vicki for picking me up. And in all seriousness, I had this overwhelming moment just a few moments ago, looking out in the crowd like I thought I was going to see someone I knew from Oklahoma or maybe from Texas. And I didn't see anyone I knew, and I thought, I don't know anyone here. And all of a sudden, that voice inside me said, you know everybody who's going to come in this room. There won't be any strangers here. There won't be anyone who doesn't understand. We're privileged to be in this room. How many people on earth ever get that? This room with all these people in it, and there's no one in here who doesn't understand you. They might be different. They might not like you real well right at first, but probably if I heard everybody's story in here, if I could read your heart for just a minute, I'd know, I'd understand. That's a pretty big blessing. We're not strangers to each other. I was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm 47. I got sober. I got continuously sober and have been continuously sober since June 10th, 1982. Yes. Yay, God. I'm a miracle, and I'm here for some reason, and I hope if there's someone out there that I'm supposed to say something that will help them or hold them on this path that we're really all on together, I hope I can get myself out of the way enough to do that. I don't have any dramatic childhood stories to tell you. I wasn't abused. I grew up in an intact home with a sister and a brother, two real decent parents that were married for years and years and years until they died. They weren't alcoholics. And why my brother, my sister, and I were all completely crazy, I'll have no idea. They took us to a good Lutheran church every Sunday, and we're just, you know, genetically inferior or something. I mean, we are crazy. My sister's dead, but my brother follows the pattern. I just can't say why. And I might as well get right out there and step on any toes I can right off the bat. This is not the opinion of AA, this is the opinion of Diana Clark. But it's the opinion after 15 years of sobriety and sponsoring a lot of people that you're not going to hear a bunch of stuff from me about your boundaries or your inner child, which I think you can find by sticking your head up your rear, because if she's in there, my sponsor told me I'd find her that way. Toes, are they in pain yet? Codependency and all of that, and don't, you know, all the archaeological, let's go back to why we're like this. I just can't offer you any help on me because there's just no reason. I'm like this because I'm a human being. I was designed to not be able to cope with life on this earth without a lot of help, and I was born in a sea of fear. And I can't explain to you why. I never knew a day's hunger. And I never had a reason to not feel safe. My parents didn't hit each other. They didn't shoot at each other. I never wanted for anything except the feeling that I was safe. And I was just born that way. I never felt like I belonged anywhere. I never felt like I fit in. I can tell you that when I was little, pretty much still true, I was overweight, but I was very overweight at one point. And I had buck teeth that stuck straight out in front of me so bad that they put my picture in a magazine for before and after pictures of braces and mouth redoing. And I wasn't very cute, and I knew it. But I was a little bookworm, and I was always the real smart one, and life was very painful for me. For no outside reason. It's what's inside of me. And I just never felt like I was good enough. I never felt like the other kids liked me very well. And, you know, like a alcoholic waiting to drink, I react to people not liking me or not doing what I want by acting worse than ever. You know, still to this day, if I think I'm wrong, I'm going to talk louder. That's just the way I do. And I'm sure I was obnoxious like that when I was little. I finished school in Tulsa, and, you know, I was a sitting duck, a young woman who never feels secure, has the fears that alcoholism breeds, and I always thought that if I had a boyfriend, I was okay, and I usually managed to have one way or the other. When I was 21, I had the guy I was going with announce that he wasn't going to marry me no matter what. So I just found someone else and married them. And I knew that guy that I married 7 weeks, and I married him because he drank as much as I did. So I was off and running pretty good at 21. I had started college at the University of Tulsa. I hear and don't remember real well that I drank quite a bit there. But I've always been real good at studying and taking tests and making good grades and bluffing my way through anything that's intellectual. I stayed married to that guy for 3 years. It's hard for me now at 47 with 15 years of sobriety to go back in my mind and remember how ugly those years were. And that was only the beginning of the ugliness. 21 to 24, I'm married to Mike, two drunks in a house. Thank God he didn't beat me. Thank God more that we didn't have any children. It was a typical alcoholic marriage. That insidious ugliness that nothing stops when you're drunk or sober. You have the big blowout fights when you're drunk, but even when you're sober, you're both on your own agenda in your own world, dealing with your own fear, your own pain, your own self-centeredness. It doesn't make a marriage. At 3 years, we parted ways. I don't know where he went, and I don't care. Didn't care then. I care today. He's an alcoholic, of course, and I think maybe he's gotten some help. But my main concern when I got rid of him was to continue what became a pattern for me, which was find another one. Find another man so you can kind of, you know, got to get that in place in your life. Got to have enough scotch, got to have a man, and then everything else will fall into place. You can get down to the serious business of living. And I immediately found another guy in a bar, and I married him in 11 days. This is, I know, a display of extreme judgment out of an intellectually astute woman, but sometimes I think they pulled out part of my brains with my teeth that they took out. Thank God he didn't beat me up, and thank God more that we didn't have any kids. I stayed married to him from the time I was 24 to 27. I just loved to get one of them. And then I'd look over at them, probably within a week or two of marrying them, and see their head on that pillow all smashed up, or have heard them throwing up in the toilet all the night before. And I didn't want to be married to them anymore. So it's about 2 weeks of commitment and 2 years, 11 months, and 2 weeks of trying to get out of it. I'm real quick to get into them, but real slow to slide out of them. And by the time I was rid of him, I had already set my eyes, or my boss had set his eyes on me, in real estate. I had graduated from college at the University of Tulsa with that flamingly successful degree in sociology, taken an 80-day tour as a probation and parole officer for the state of Oklahoma, decided I wasn't near as big-hearted as I thought I was, and I'd just go into real estate. So I did. Now I'm drinking. I'm drinking every day. If I get off saying something funny or trying to get you to feel sorry for me or something, and I'm not talking about booze, just take it to the bank. I'm drinking every day through every bit of anything I'm telling you. Later on, you can take it to the bank that I'm taking Valium to, but right now we'll just drink a lot of scotch. But I was messed up. So somewhere, and I'm not going to be able to talk long enough to explain the timing to you, and don't even bother to try to figure it out. If you're really curious how this all fits together, you'll have to talk to me after I speak. I managed to adopt two children. Somewhere, when I was about 27, this sudden urge to have a baby hit me. I think I thought that was going to be like some people's geographic cure. But I had this kind of Mother Teresa side to me. I always pictured myself after my zero population growth classes and classes about man and technology and all the needy people. I was going to do something real wonderful, like adopt 20 children with massive handicaps. Now, I couldn't even take care of myself. I'm drinking so hard, but it seemed like a realistic plan. So, and I never liked babies that much. I was the child, and the only dolls I ever wanted were bride dolls. Seriously, got one every Christmas. Oh, just get me a bride doll. Should have known better. But at 27, I already had my life so messed up. The history of my life, the black and white paper of my life with the marriages. I'm on my third marriage. I'm a mess. No, haven't displayed a whole lot of stability. Straight A student. I got a degree, but I can't seem to hold down a job. I wasn't going to get a baby from an agency. And you can bet this guy I had married was not the paragon of virtue either. My boss, these guys I married went downhill, not up. My judgment didn't get any better. He already had 3-4 marriages behind him and 4 daughters I knew about and a son I didn't. And, you know, he was a mess. Of course, drinkers. These guys I marry are all drunks. So we're drinking every night, and I'm plotting how I'm going to get a baby, and now, right now. Wasn't because I couldn't have a baby. I just wasn't going to wait 9 months. So, funny, but I'm serious. It's getting close to Christmas. November. Got to do something. So, I mean, I just get these plans that just take off in my head. I'm going to marry this man and he's going to save me. I'm going to get rid of him and that's going to fix me. I'm going to have a career doing that, career doing that. Probably sounds familiar. I'm going to adopt a baby. You know, I'm going to be a farmer. I took Mother Earth News for years. I'll go out and build me a windmill and a geodesic dome. Forget this education. I'm going to raise a goat and a chicken. If I could just find the perfect man. So now it's the baby thing. So I announce everywhere I go, I always was a real good salesperson. Everywhere I go, I announce that I've got to find this baby that's meant for me. And this woman that sold real estate at the same company as me told me that she knew where a baby was going to be born in Arkansas that I could sure have if I wanted, and I better think long and hard about it. Oh, nothing to think about. Off and running. Didn't care that the, you know, it was supposed to be a biracial baby, and the woman was 19 and it was her fifth child, and she was a heroin addict and an active alcoholic. Worst of possible of conditions. She was the product being recorded. I have to be a little careful because my son's 21 now, of some serious genetic problems, we'll say. But I was going to have that baby. And if you think the God that you either have found or will find in this program isn't big enough to use your worst motives for the best things to bring good out of your life, you just need to rethink that statement when I get finished telling you my story. I get this child. We get her to Tulsa. I never met her. We start an ordeal trying to keep her here. They did the x-rays. Baby probably wasn't going to live, blah, blah, blah. But we go through a lot. And the baby did live. My son, John, as I said, he's 21 today. And he was in pediatric intensive care for quite a long time after he was born, and they didn't know if he would live, and they didn't know what would be wrong with him. But by the grace of God, despite five very synergistic learning disabilities, despite me being told when he was in the first grade that he was retarded and he would never read, if he could walk here among you right now and walk in the back, you would feel the aura of an angel. He reads, he graduated, reads everything. He graduated from regular high school after being pulled out and put in a lot of special ed and out of public school for a long time because they didn't believe he could be taught to read. He's married and he's doing real well. 2 years after I adopted John, I decided that maybe another baby would fix me. I think in the back of my mind, what I was really thinking about was how much I drank and how empty life was except for my son, John. The love I feel for my sons is incomparable to anything else I've ever known. And what I've put them through, the destruction, is pretty incomparable too. But right when I brought this helpless little baby that didn't weigh 5 pounds home from pediatric intensive care, my son John, for some magic reason I quit drinking. I knew he had to be fed every hour and a half, and by God's grace I quit drinking. And I didn't drink for several weeks, and that was the happiest, up till that point in my life, that's the happiest I had ever been. The combination of the child and the guilt off of me and the not drinking. So 2 years after he's born, I decide I need another baby, and I get another child on the gray market adoptions, they call them. They're perfectly legal, but not through any agency. I took another child for a very questionable background situation that wasn't going to be wanted. And that's my son, Paul, who's now 19. And he was born at full term. His mother had a little more care, although we had alcohol problems with her, and they suspected for a long time he had alcohol fetal syndrome. But he weighed 8.5 pounds when I took him home, and he was kind of raucous and pushed me away, and I just didn't need to stop drinking. Of course, the truth of the matter is I was 2 years further in my disease, and I couldn't stop drinking. And I never stopped drinking when I brought him home. And I just don't know what he got. I don't know how much nurturing he got. I know I made things look good the next few years. I always kept my kids in real cute clothes and real spanky shoes. And I always thought I had them looking real good. Boy, they had all their shots, and, you know, their money wasn't a big problem by then. I'd been financially fairly successful in real estate. So had my husband, my boss in real estate. And only later, after I was sober, did I happen to be flipping through that little stack of pictures they take every single year of your kids. And I noticed that my kids would be sitting there in their little white knee-high socks and red patent leather shoes and some adorable little outfit with their little hands crossed. So cute. Except their hair was clear down in their eyes. It so badly needed to be cut. And they had the emptiest look on their little faces. I didn't know what I was doing to them because I was so busy trying to figure out what I was doing to me. I was so afraid of everything. Money didn't fix the fear. Looking good didn't fix the fear. Having the kids and keeping them fixed up didn't fix the fear. Nothing seemed to fix the fear. And I believed in God. The Lutheran upbringing I had served me well. I believed in a very loving, all-inclusive God. Very strongly stanced against bigotry and hate. I believed love was the solution to everything. A lot of good underpinning things. None of it changed the emptiness in my life. I've come to realize, I've learned here, that it really doesn't matter how long you live. This has helped me when I've lost friends to sudden heart attack, AIDS, the drinking, suicide. It doesn't matter how long you live. It matters how empty your life is or isn't. And my life, I can tell you today at 47, my life's already been so full that if I die tonight, I've had more, not just more than I deserve, but more than hardly anyone even gets of what matters. It's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I forgot where I was, but I was someplace. I always was. Life's bouncing along, and I've got these two children, and there's a lot of screaming and arguing in our home, and I've brought a lot of problems on myself at this point. I'm 29 or 30, and, you know, I've been married too many times, and one of my kids, really, the younger one, is wild. Man, he had a lot of problems. And I didn't know about John's learning disabilities yet, and I'm drinking to the point of drunk, flat out, 7 days a week, every night. But I'm not an alcoholic because I'm not drinking in the morning or anything. And I haven't been picked up for a DUI. And, you know, the times I backed out of my driveway in my Cadillac and just took out half the brick wall 3 times, they put it back. I wonder what those guys thought was happening. And I just knocked the gas light right off its pole. It was probably just spewing gas all over Tulsa, but I was so drunk, I didn't even care, you know. That kind of stuff didn't matter. I didn't get a DUI. Wasn't in jail. I was too classy to be an alcoholic. I was that combination of the most arrogant, know-it-all, talk-loud, non-nurturing, cold bitch who was so scared and desperate to figure out how to give love, how to get love, how to get this life under control. And I became more desperate every single day. But I brought all those problems on myself. And I kind of knew it. And I've always kind of enjoyed problems I brought on myself. I maybe didn't enjoy them, but I could forgive them and rationalize them. And since I brought them in my life, I could kind of love them and nurture them. But all of a sudden, life started handing me problems that all my cleverness, oh, I was always so clever, all my cleverness, good grades, money, fake arrogance and self-confidence, none of it would help. And they weren't problems that were acceptable. I found out my father was real, real sick, and I loved my father. And he was 63 years old. He'd never been sick a day in his life. I still live in Tulsa right there, you know. Had a very small family anyway. My father, my mother, my sister, my brother, and me. My aunt and uncle are not even to be included because I didn't even know them. I had an adopted cousin who had run away from home and never been heard of since. No grandparents. One great aunt who was like my grandmother, and I adored her, my Aunt Maud. It's a small family. There's not much there to lose. My father was so ill, and he stayed sick for 16 months, and then he died. But during that 16 months, I became the only blood donor, the only apheresis blood donor, where they take out 8 units of your blood every week to take out what he needs to keep him alive. And while I was in the middle of that, I'm going to try to put this together for you. I'm married to my third husband. I have little babies, you know, that are like 1 and 3. This isn't going to add up. I'm no good at numbers. And my husband's 4 stepdaughters' mother has dropped them off in our yard. They're 16, 15, 14, and 11. I'm going to fix them. Oh, boy, this is just escalating my Mother Teresa plan. I'll buy them all new clothes. I'll buy them, they'll have clean underwear. You know how little girls who are running wild and never had any love, they're totally insecure and nuts and already on drugs and having abortions and stuff. If you just buy them clean underwear, that'll fix everything. Especially if you feed them vegetables and have dinner at home every night. So I had it all under control. And I'm telling you, our life was so insane with those 6 kids, my father dying, me doing phoresis, and my husband and I just raging alcoholics. Of course, I found Valium. That did help. If you know, if you're really in trouble, try a little of that, too, because that's helpful. And I found out, you know, right in the middle of doing this phoresis, I got real sick. And I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I found out I was pregnant. Well, I'd never been pregnant. And I've never been pregnant since. And they took me in a room with a bunch of doctors and said, your dad's going to bleed to death in 21 days if you don't get rid of this baby, and we will not put you back on the phoresis machine till you are not pregnant. And at my mother's insistence, and maybe with a sense of relief, I don't know, I had an abortion. That really hurt me. That hurt. And, you know, to this day, I know, January 4th, my father went ahead and died. My mother suddenly died after my father. My father died. I'd lost the baby on January 4th. My dad died on May 10th. My mother died on December 18th. And then my beloved Aunt Maud died 89 days after my mother. The whole family was wiped out as far as I was concerned. And to me, drinking, taking Valium, just blurring my life, 6 kids I was supposed to be taking care of. My kids wouldn't have gotten what little babies need if there hadn't been any other kids in the house. But that was just more chaos. They were floating, let me tell you. They didn't get anything. And my life was in such chaos that I can't stand here at this podium and put words to it. I was having a nightmare every night that I was still trying to fix it with things. We had a place at the lake that would make it better, and I had a mink coat and a lot of real pretty jewelry, and I was having this nightmare that I was in a bathtub taking a shower, and I had on my mink coat and my jewelry, and this isn't really as funny as it sounds, and a hand would come in and take the coat, and I felt real naked, like I didn't have my covering, my facade, my mask, and then it would jewelry, and I put my jewelry in that hand, and it would go away, and Diana, standing there in the bathtub, would just become black. I would just melt and become this kind of brown, brackish water and just go down the drain. So I didn't think I was anything. I really, if you had just cut me open, you would have gotten that brown, cancerous ooze that comes from a soul that is as dry as the driest sponge on earth and desperate for the water of some kind of spiritual life. At that point, I think God could see that I wasn't going to make it. I was at the height of my craziness. I was crazy because of these deaths. I had a nervous breakdown and wouldn't go to the hospital. I was afraid they would take my children away from me. Who they'd be, I don't know. I was going out to my parents' grave. In case you doubt that you're melodramatic, if you can understand this, you're in trouble. I was going out to my parents' grave, spreading myself out across my mother and father's grave in broad daylight with a fifth of scotch in one hand and a 38 Smith & Wesson loaded with hollow point bullets so I'd be sure to get the job done. In the other hand, asking God loud, I'm sure, so all the caretakers and everyone would see me, to give me enough nerve to shoot myself. And when they couldn't find me, they'd go out there and I'd be laying out there across the grave. You know, it seemed pretty normal to me. That'd scrape me up, and that'd be good for everybody to just be hovering over me for 2 or 3 days. I milked those deaths and the tragedy of it for all it was worth as long as I could. Truly, it was an alcoholic and drug addict extreme. Because everybody feels so sorry for you, they didn't blame you for drinking and drugging. And it got as bad as it could get. At that point, my second husband called me out of the clear blue sky, and he said, I need to talk to you. We need to go to coffee. We did. He'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you think everybody in the world's heard of us, don't be so sure. This was 1981, and I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. I knew the word alcoholic, but all the typical stereotypes in my mind. When he talked to me, he did his ninth step, and he saved my life. He never told me I was an alcoholic. I knew I was. I said, what do? I have the same problem. And he didn't try to 12-step me. He gave me the central service number, and I started going to noon meetings the next day. I wouldn't go to night meetings because I knew the real alcoholics went to night meetings. And I knew you were desperate if you went to night meetings. So I was just kind of a still upper middle class alcoholic. So I went to the noon meetings for 90 days, and not knowing it, but knowing now as I look back, that's where I had the magic dust of Alcoholics Anonymous fall on me, an expression of the grace of God. There is a magic dust in these rooms. I used to think this was silly and wouldn't tell you all about it, but I've had some mighty old timers tell me to tell it. There is seriously magic dust that comes in on you when you came through those doors. And if you try hard to feel it on your skin, you will. And it is the dust falling off the angel wings of the angels that are flying around in this room above our heads. And that magic dust fell on this unwilling, arrogant, unteachable, unloving, and unlovable woman that came in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1981. And for 90 days, just that magic kept me sober. I didn't like you. I didn't feel like I belonged. I didn't feel like you loved me. But I don't care if it's the worst down and out person on the back row someplace that never stays, never says the prayer, and hates us. The magic dust fell on him. And it's hard to shake off. I went back out there for 9 months and drank again. And I drank hard, and it got just as bad as it ever did after that initial 6 weeks of thinking I controlled it. And it got worse and worse and worse. And one night, my husband and I had one of our extremely ugly arguments, and he shot at me with that .38, loaded with a hollow point bullet. And I remember he missed, very narrowly missed. And I remember thinking, thank God those babies are asleep. And they weren't. They were in the door, seeing it. And when I tucked them away, I saw that look in their eyes I can see now in those pictures, and I told them it'd never be like this again. And the next day, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, June 10th, 1982. They say you have to come for yourself. I mightily disagree. I didn't like myself well enough to get sober or try to give a better life, get to a better life or a spiritual life. I was too far down in that fear, the mire, the muck, the drugs, the alcohol. But I loved those children, and I knew they'd had all any children should have to go through. And I came back to AA and stayed here I don't know how long for John and Paul. And I'm telling you, I am a walking, talking miracle today. So if I don't tell people you can only come in for yourself, come in any way you can get here and stay for any reason. I've had people I sponsor stay sober coming in just looking for a man. You know, it'll get you. That dust will get you. You got to kind of trust the power of the program. Well, this is the point when I came back and was really desperate, willing to do anything, willing to go to any lengths, that the full grace of God shone on me. I didn't realize it. I would not have realized it for years until more things unfolded. The grace of God for me is unmerited divine assistance. that was given and is given to me for my regeneration. And every bit of that matters. It's unmerited. Because if I had had to deserve it or had to toe any certain line to get it, I'd be dead now. And it's divine assistance, thank God, because there's something down in all of us and in me that suspects that no human power was going to stop my alcoholism, nor is any human power going to keep me from having a drink tonight. I'm relieved it's something bigger than anything I know, because I know a lot of things, and I still want to control them. And they weren't able to help me before. Unmerited divine assistance given to me, given a gift. A gift like when the Christmas I saved up and bought my boys those two yellow bicycles that they wanted so bad. Couldn't wait to give them to them on Christmas morning. That's how God is with me in this grace, with you in this grace. Man, he's bought your yellow bicycles, and he is not withholding. Given to me for my regeneration. And I love the word regeneration. I used to resent it because I thought I was pretty cool anyway. But I love rose bushes. And my best example is I love rose bushes. I'm obsessed about them. I mean, I could tell you everything about roses. I raise them. A rose bush that's in full bloom and its thorns are covered by this beautiful green leaves that are coming on them right now and has its little buds and no black spot disease and fungus and all that. It's just beautiful. It doesn't need regeneration. But at Walmart in the fall puts rose bushes that they haven't been able to sell the whole season out on this wooden bench in Tulsa for a dollar. And the dollar bushes are pathetic. They're black canes. Their thorns show. There's not one leaf on them. They look dead. They have these plastic sacks around them that are split open, and their dirt is falling out, and they haven't been watered, fed, and then they've got these little wires choking their necks that hold the plastic sack on. They need regeneration. And all kidding aside, I was a dollar rose when I got to you. And the wire that was choking my neck was alcoholism. My kids were 5 and 7 when I sobered up. I thought their problems would go away. Their problems got worse, got a lot worse. My husband and I got a divorce. And I'm proud to tell you that for all these years since they were 5 and 7, except for one 89-day slip, I have not been married again. It was a little slip. But you see, I thought God told me to do it. I guess he didn't. So I raised him by myself, basically, without my family. My brother was a hopeless drug addict in Kansas by now. My sister died of multiple sclerosis in a nursing home. And the kids had terrible problems. Terrible problems. And if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous, it's easy to say I wouldn't have stayed sober. But I'll tell you what, those kids wouldn't have had a mother. And they wouldn't have ever had a chance. And they're not kids who would have had a chance. You gave me the strength. My fears didn't go away. They haven't gone away today. I mean, every time they tell me something's wrong with my kids, would fall clear apart, take it to the end, you know, in my mind. You gave me the strength. The Women's Love and Alcoholics Anonymous and my sponsor. And I could spend an hour telling you about my sponsor, who is my mother. My first sponsor I got finally became my mother, and then she died when I was 2 years sober. And I got her sponsor, and she's been my mother. And I have sisters, brothers. My brother and I don't have a very good relationship to this day. He's clean and sober for many years. And it hurts real bad because he's my only relative. But I have brothers, and I have parents and grandparents, all you in the family, in my family here. We took the problems with the kids one at a time. I got regular jobs where I could get health insurance. There were a lot of big health problems that I haven't told you about with the kids. And my youngest son, Paul, was finally diagnosed as one of those unbonded, unattached children with no conscience that's just died in the world, psychopath. And he did a lot of real crazy things. Setting fires, stabbing, cheating, lying. I mean, he was real far gone by the time he was 5 or 6. And thank God I was sober because I never would give up on him. And it was very tempting. When he was 9, I'd taken him to Colorado for more therapy and help out there. And they told me, you need to bear down on Diana because you may not ever be able to fix Paul. And a long stint in Al-Anon taught me the hardest lesson of my life. And the best lesson. Nobody is placed on this earth to live up to my expectations. Not my parents, not my spouse, children, nobody. Sponsor. Every single human being has a right to be exactly the way they are. But boy, that was hard for me to face with my youngest son. Because I'm not kidding when I say he was headed towards serial murder, prison, all sorts of problems. By the time he was 13, he was a drug addict, an alcoholic. Right after he came back from our deal with Foster Klein and the holding therapy and rage reduction and all in Colorado, with the help of AA and the push of his therapist, I got refocused on myself. I found it convenient to sidestep my life, except for my life in AA. I always went to meetings. I sponsored. Everything that was good in my life came from this program. And during those hard, hard years raising those kids alone, little tight on money, way tight on support with them. Their dad didn't pay child support. He never came to visit them. I had them 365 days a year. Couldn't leave the youngest one with a babysitter. He could do something unbelievable. The only good thing I had was AA. But I got enough love and respect and nurturing here through God, through this grace of God, to continuously be regenerating, and I didn't know that. I was asked by Paul's doctor in Tulsa one day when I was trying to face it, he may not be salvageable. It's real hard with a child. Most people probably don't understand what I'm saying. He said, did you ever have a dream? And I said, don't talk to me about dreams. I'm a drunk. Got years of sobriety. I can feed my kids. I have car insurance that's paid for the next 6 months. A warm place to live. A lot of friends in AA. But don't push your luck, because my dream is just to even have it be like this. I mean, when you have these children and you're single, you're pretty worn down. He said, nope, I'm not letting up. What did you ever dream about being? This being an administrative assistant where you are and all. You can be more. What, or you can be something more, something that's for you. You are a child of God. And I reached back in my memory, not out of any big spiritual reason, but because this doctor was so good looking, I had such a crush on him, I always tried to do what he said. And I remembered, you know, Abraham Lincoln has always been my hero. Since I was the littlest memory, Abraham Lincoln, I called him. And he was a lawyer, and I told my daddy if he was a lawyer, I was going to be a lawyer. And that took off my dream. I always wanted to be a lawyer. I loved the law. I'd been offered a fellowship to go to law school when I graduated when I was 23. Many years have passed now. And I'm in my late 30s, and I didn't go because the husband I was married to at the time thought it was stupid, and, you know, I needed a drink, so I didn't take the fellowship, and then I didn't go. And he said, well, I want you to go over to TU and get the law school catalog. Geez, what for? Well, I got mad and I left, but I knew I had to get the catalog because he was going to ask it for me the next week, ask for it. So I went by and I got it. And with the guidance of my sponsor and this little fledgling strength and courage that had somehow grown in me over those years, 5, 6, 7 years of sobriety, I ended up taking the LSAT. And I knew I couldn't go to law school, but I thought it would be enough that I had touched my dream. And that's what I want to tell you here tonight, is touch your dream. No matter how old you are, how young you are, how ridiculous it is, how small it is, it may be to learn how to grow roses, it may be to do volunteer work, it may be to be a doctor, but whatever your dream is, don't throw it away. It's yours. It's given to you from God, and your little soul knows what it is. it was enough for me to take the LSAT and spend $60 we didn't have. I was very proud of myself. And my sponsor taught me that. She said, you don't have to go to law school, but just touch your dream. You're so scared you won't even touch it, like it's going to bite you or something. So I took it. And then I got kind of excited when I got the results because the grace of God took the LSAT. I blew the top off the LSAT. And I didn't even think my brain cells still worked. And I knew a lot of stuff about the juvenile courts and stuff like that. TU not only accepted me, but in my letter of acceptance, which was all I wanted, I couldn't go to law school. You have to go full time. I got to work to feed these kids. I was so thrilled to get the letter of acceptance. And in the same package, a few pages back, was a letter that said, Dear Ms. Clark, the Merit Scholarship Committee is met, and we're going to give you a full scholarship. I never talked to financial aid. I never applied for any help. I never intended to go. But God intended for me to go. And boy, that AA kicked right in. You know, my sponsor said, that's a burning bush. You're going to go. You know. Took me 2 days to decide whether or not I was even going to tell her I got offered the scholarship. I knew I was in trouble. I knew it had gone too far. That's when I learned about the free fall of faith. Don't let fear stop you. I never was so afraid in my life. I'd love to stand up here and report to you all that the program and my faith in God and this wonderful spiritual foundation that I have now has stopped the fear, but I'd be lying. I'm very afraid of many things, but I don't have to act out of it anymore. With some planning and some encouragement from my home group and my sponsor kicking me, her encouragement's a sharp toe in the rear, I sold my house, car, jewelry, everything. Put the money in the bank, split it into 36 payments to us, quit my job, took the scholarship, and went to law school. And I sat my kids down and said, this is the way it's going to be. We're going to be really poor for 3 years, but I'm going to law school, and you're not going to stop me. It's been for you all these years. We're going to go as a team. It's going to make our life better. And you can't believe the things I had to overcome in law school. My second year of law school, they called me one night. As I said, the numbers won't add up. I'm just no good at this. But Paul was 13, I think. He had stolen a truck, driven it halfway across Oklahoma. He had 2 loaded guns and extra clips on the seat and fertilizer bombs like they used to blow up the federal building that he had built in the back of the truck because he was going to blow up his school. And he was a really little, cute 13-year-old. I had to go meet him down at the police station. Thank you, Al-Anon. I left him there. They told me I had to take him home. He was too little to go to the detention center. You know, they really don't have anything to do with kids that age. I don't put them in prison. And, but, you know, maybe the charges would be pressed in juvenile court and all, but I had to take him home. And I said, and believe me, I didn't have to go down there by myself at 2 in the morning. I made one call and people in AA came and went with me. It's a good thing, too, because I really wanted a drink. And with their encouragement and the strength of the magic dust that flows between us in a crisis, I told him to put me in jail. I wasn't going to take him home. I wasn't going to take him home under any conditions. And if he got hurt in a detention center or gang raped or something, he better learn what it was going to be like to go to prison. And I did the hardest thing I've ever done in my life when I turned around and walked out and left my beloved child there. And he stayed in the detention center for 12 days. They put a $50,000 bail on his head and 5 juvenile felonies, all in. He spent 7 months in a psychiatric hospital. All this time I'm trying to go to law school as a single mother. Get up at 5, study till 7, do the deal, go to school, get out of school, go to the psychiatric hospital, visit Paul. That's where I find out he's an alcoholic. You'd think I would have known. I didn't. He's drinking every day at lunch. He's nuts. It's my first ray of hope because he's been nuts since he was born. He came out of there. He made it for a while. He did real good. Then they got him at school for distributing methamphetamine. Shoot needles in both arms. Crank. My little brown-eyed speed freak. By the grace of God and the fact that I had gotten out of law school and been offered the best job anyone in my class got, I graduated in single-digit numbers in the rankings out of a class of 248 kids because God went with me. I didn't panic through law school. I was very scared, but God means good orderly direction. And I studied and I did the best I could. And I went to meetings, just as always, because my sponsor said, I'd rather have you make C's and stay sober than make A's and get drunk. I had no choice. She gave me no choice. I had a very good job at a very good law firm, and a lot of strings were pulled, and I got my son when he was busted at school in a prison alternative camp, boot camp, ranch in Oklahoma, and he stayed there for 14 months. And when he was 16, he had a spiritual experience in an electrical storm. He's not maybe clean and sober today. He's 19. But he's really not using drugs today. He drinks some, but it's not taking him down. And this may sound kind of off the wall, but he really did have a spiritual experience. And my son had such grave mental and emotional disorders as a sociopath that fixing that problem with a spiritual experience had to be done first. And God has fixed it. That child has never been empty like he was before. He would never bomb a place. He sat and wept and told me how much he loved me, the things he'd done, which are horrendous, that I didn't know, and that he took so much out on me. I have laid awake nights and wondered if he was going to come in my bedroom and try to murder me. That he took it so much out on me because I was the only person he knew. Never, ever leave him. And that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't give up. And he may die. He may be sticking a needle in his arm right now someplace in Norman, Oklahoma. And he may be dead. But I'll be okay. And I'll take the last good memories I've had. I've lived from good memory through bad to good memory. Because my life is mine to live. It's mine to love and serve in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to save him. I don't know who I have to save or who I can even help save. But I may be doing more God's work standing here and talking to you all than trying to bug him like I did for years. As I said, I got out of law school. I went to work for this big Lily White firm, and life got better for us financially and worse for me. I sunk into a terrible depression. One, I was not in an atmosphere I could flourish in. It was very political. They didn't know I was an alcoholic. They had no idea I'd been married all these times. I was the only single mother they had ever hired, and this was a firm established in the early 1900s. I mean, we were so proper. And it was a nightmare, you know, work late, work on weekends. I wouldn't do it. Thanks to AA, I just told them, no, fire me. Well, they weren't going to fire me. They liked me, so I was really the little renegade. Eventually, the law firm broke up, and I got kind of in a bidding war between the two kings at butt heads, and ended up with like a $20,000 a year raise, but no one ever even heard of such a thing. I only had like 3 years out of law school. It was really fun. And it didn't have anything to do with marriage. It was just that I was the one they both wanted to keep. So I did that for a year. I worked for the other big law firm. And then I did the nervy free fall of faith thing one more time and said, I can't stay in this big firm atmosphere till they get their claws around my soul and I'm getting close to a partnership. I'm going to go out on my own all by myself. And people come up to me now at conferences sometimes and say, I heard your tape when you were going to go out on your own. You'd made up your mind, found the office, and how's it going? Well, it's going the way it goes. When you're God's child and when God's unmerited divine assistance, your yellow bike is given to you for your regeneration and you're taught to ride slowly, but it was just as fast as God could teach me. My practice has boomed beyond all belief. I've homed in on the area of law I said I would never do, and it's my specialty, domestic. Everything that's ever happened to me, every bad thing, has paid off in the practice of law and in the more important endeavor of my life, my real career, which is serving God in Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't be me. I could have never been brought to my smart aleck knees if I hadn't gone through the pain I've been through. Please understand that I didn't come in the program, become a lawyer, and now I'm doing real good. I came in the program, I made a lot of mistakes, I was in bad relationships, I whined and griped about my kids, I thought everybody else was getting rich but me and finding their dream. I was years sober before I went to law school. And it was only probably 2 years ago, and I'd been out of law school for 3 years at that point or more, that I stood in a conference and said, you know, yeah, I'm a lawyer, that's real cool, it's a real dramatic story to tell, it's real impressive. But let me tell you something even better. I am a wonderful mother. But I can tell you that today, and it's true. I accept those two children, 19 and 21, the way they are for what they are. With kids, you take what you get, and you do the best you can with it. Doesn't matter if you adopt them or they're yours or anything else, and they belong to God. Don't take the credit if it turns out bad, and don't. You know, I mean, don't take the guilt, the blame if it turns out bad, and you can't take the credit if it turns out good. Both my kids are okay today. They're just okay. Your kid may have gone to Harvard. I'm real thrilled when my kid can get a C in algebra in junior college, and it's just as much a miracle or more. I could not possibly tell you in human language what my life is like today. But it is so good. I used to get up and wonder, what am I going to do today? And how am I going to handle, whatever it was overwhelming, even in sobriety. There's just not enough hours. There's not enough years to live. There's not enough energy in me to just gather up all the good. And being a lawyer has been the biggest disappointment of my life. I never was so scared in my life. I thought for the first 4.5 years, I mean, I threw up on a regular basis out of fear. I couldn't hardly go. I'd go to court. Of course, I'm just like I am tonight. I'm scared to death. I'm nauseated. But you all think I'm real confident. I'm like this in court, so I always win. Then you get more business, and they want you to go to court, and they'll give you big retainers, and you don't know, I don't want to go to court. I want to settle. How do they want to settle? I found that I can be so honest with people out on my own. If they're scared and they're crying and they're embarrassed to tell me something, I can share a little bit of my background with them, put them at ease real fast. I sent people to Al-Anon and told them I won't represent them until they go to 6 meetings. Had a lot of marriages stay together. Every Christmas, my paralegal and I put the pictures on our door into our office of the divorces that never panned out, that we never had to actually go get the divorce. I said I'd never do custody, and we have a little gallery of children that every one of them, God's given me the situation, and as scared as I wasn't willing to hand it off to someone that was an expert at litigating custody because I didn't think they'd pay enough attention to the case. Every day in this career that I thought I'd fight through those 3 hard years and then I'd be on easy street, I'm always waiting, you know, I'm always waiting. I'm not waiting anymore. I don't know when that happened. It's a miracle. Even though it's not fun to work at this job, financially it's been beyond belief. And in the joy it's brought me and the fulfillment it's brought me, it's been second only to AA. I have been able to work. I have been able to be in God's field in very heavily weeded rows. You wouldn't even recognize it as a cultivatable field. And I've been able to hold a good, sturdy hoe and work to the end of my row many times with many people. And I can't tell you what a feeling it's given me. I have so many people I love and who love me. I've learned to quit expecting my brother to love and adore me, that God's going to give me everything I need. Love, respect, safety, good feelings, affection, someone to need and nurture me. He's going to give me all that. It's just, in my case, it ain't going to be from my brother. It ain't going to be from the place I demanded. And I'm going to be looking at that hot dog and passing over the steak I get laid in front of me by the other people in AA. We'll all get all the love and affection we need. If it's not from that relative or that kid, you so badly, your heart's so crippled wanting it, it doesn't matter, you'll get it. I've got so much more I could tell you, but I've already talked over. But I'm going to do something I've never done. I got on the plane today, and God said write. And I write occasionally, but believe me, no one ever sees it. I immediately put it in the computer under the password, which is only known to someone who's going to handle my will. You know, I'm so important. But I want to read to you what I wrote. And I thought, I'm supposed to tell this when I talk tonight. I'm supposed to tell it first thing. And then I thought, no, I'm just going to tell my story like I always do, and then I'm going to read it. The miracle, one more time. These words just flew down on the paper. I'm on the plane. God uses the reality, the events of my life, to shape and reshape my soul and my understanding. I get on the plane, and it starts to sink in. I've spoken at a lot of conferences, and this feeling comes over me. I am wanted in Nebraska. I am wanted to share my miracle. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Oh, yeah, that. God, I've been too busy for that, climbing the mountain of life. Yeah, I go to meetings and all that, but I don't home in on the aerial view of the miracle of my life, the manifestation of the grace of God. The manifestation of God's grace in the one little life of Diana Clark. What was it like? Hell? How can I describe it? Trying to cope, achieve, survive without basic equipment. I was trying to climb the mountain, and I had the anchor stake. I knew there was a God. I knew there was a power greater than me that could help me. I had that, I don't know what you mountain climbers call it, but the thing you drive in, I'm going to call it the anchor stake. But I had no rope to connect my body to the stake, and I didn't know how to use the hammer to drive the stake in the mountain. I just had it. In a stone mountainside of life. At a young age, fear and insecurity, the lack of ever feeling safe, caused me to fall off the mountain. I had to look down. You know, they tell you don't look down, but I had to look down, and then I had to look up. Down to what had happened and may happen, the danger, the pits, the snares of life, and all the bad places I had been, and up to the sheer cliffs of life that I knew lay ahead. Fear overwhelmed me, and I fell off the mountain. Not dangling, falling to a sure death at the bottom. I fell into the grace of God. I was caught by the arms of AA, God's human arms, your arms. I was held safe, taught to climb, taught how to live, to reestablish myself on the mountainside and use the hammer of willingness to drive the stake, God, into that stone. And slowly you fed me the connecting rope. Slowly I learned to use my tools and stay hooked on. Willingness, even that was a gift. Now I look back down that mountain for you at conferences when I speak and when I do 12-step with women in the program. But I'm safe and I won't follow these tools. I can look back without being afraid. Unless I choose to abandon the tools, fling them away, I will never fall. They serve me well. I've climbed a great distance. I look up the mountain ahead, looks unclimbable. Oh well, so what? I have these powerful tools, teachers, fellow climbers. I have the grace of God and the wings of angels to cool me on the climb and gently catch me if I take a misstep. Fear comes, but it doesn't overwhelm me. I'm securely held to that anchor stake of God by the rope of AA wrapped around my waist. Humility will help me cling to what I've been given. I must remember when I was trying to climb all alone. The fear, the falls, the pain, the bruises, hopelessness. The constant knowing inside the task was too big for me. Now I'm singing in the comeback choir. Thank you for the rope. Thank you for showing me how to use my willingness to put my stake in. And I hope everybody here tonight stays on the mountain. The climb without the tools is harder than the climb here. May you feel the magic dust. Thank you for listening to me.